Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at The Damage Report. Today is a Tuesday. And the fun things about Tuesdays and Thursdays here at The Damage Report is that you never know who's gonna be on the show with me. We have this awesome roster of people from all different areas of media and journalism, politics, all that. We got a very exciting guest for you today, joined once again on The Damage Report by Wasni Lambre. Wasni, how's it going?
I'm good. How's everything going, my brother?
I've been, you know, as good as, you know, it could be worse. It has been worse.
Absolutely.
It will be worse in the future. Anyway, we're very lucky to have you. Wasni, if you're not familiar with him, is a culture writer, NBA writer, sports analyst, podcaster, Twitch streamer. Am I missing anything? I know that you have a lot of hats.
No, it's just, you know, that's just my West Indian nature to have 20 different jobs, you know. Rent is always due on the first, everybody. So you got to stay conscious of that at all times.
Exactly. You know what? Later on this week, we need to return to that topic because the looming eviction crisis isn't going away. The media hasn't been talking about that much. We're gonna return to that later this week. Anyway, so you raise a good point. Thank you everybody for being here, regardless of what platform you're on. If you're watching on the members app, thank you so much. If you're on Twitch, we like that too. YouTube, how's it going? Thank you for being here. Please hit the like button, share the stream so the people know we're live. And as you're probably aware, we like to you know, get to know what you all are talking about, what concerns you have, if you have any questions, anything like that. So later on in the show, during our breaks, we'll be responding to your super chats, tweets, comments, Twitter stuff, all that. And so feel free to send those in and we will get back to you about that. Through the course of the 90 minutes that we have for TDR now, we're gonna be talking about a hell of a lot. Starting off with a deep dive, necessarily, regrettably, into the backlash on critical race theory. We've got Marjorie Greene apologizing for things that she said. We'll see if she is if she has earned forgiveness. We've got a bit of Obama. We got Reality Winner being released from prison. We got crack versus cocaine sentencing. We got a lot of stuff. So hang on to your butts. We're about to launch into this. Wasni, you ready to do this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then let's start it off. If you've attended any school board meetings, PTA meetings, anything like that around the country over the past couple of months, there's a chance you've seen something like this.
Just because I do not want critical race theory taught to my children in school does not mean that I'm a racist, damn it.
Okay, so that she's going through a time. Thank you to the right and to Fox News for making that woman a wreck over critical race theory being taught to her kids in a school that doesn't teach critical race theory to their kids anyway. There's a lot of problems here, and we're gonna hit a few different angles on this. But you need to understand that critical race theory has become this massive thing that right-wing politicians have been talking about, Fox News has been talking about, and because of that, it is rapidly eclipsing, let's see, the need to rig future elections and the demonization of trans youth as the most important issue in right-wing minds. We've got a lot that we're gonna get into on this, but Wasni, what do you make of this nationwide craze against critical race theory?
I'm honestly a bit stupefied because I couldn't really tell you what critical race theory is. Like, I don't know what that means, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are they gonna teach African American studies in classrooms all across America. I find it hard to believe that that would be the case. And you know, a lot of it just feels like we don't want white people from the past to be demonized. And so, you know, because that demonization will somehow be transferred onto me. I don't get the paranoia, the just honestly, like you said, the craze around the topic of, you know, I guess talking about race in a more frank manner to students across the country. I don't get that. It's strange to me.
Yeah. You are handicapped, Wozni, by not being terrified of reality. Some people are very scared of the things that are, and they would very much like them to not be that way. But if they're going to have to be that way, please don't tell me about it. Anyway, we're going to get to a definition of critical race theory. But really fast, I want to give you a little bit more of the sort of thing that you saw with that opening video, which is these meetings are going on. Hundreds of parents are flocking to tell school administrators to stop teaching things that they are very much not teaching. And you hear things like you did in that video. You hear things like from Kids First Alliance organizer Lindy Ford, who said, "We need to be colorblind and we really need to have more unity. This is going to divide our children." You know, it's a great thing when you start off by saying that we need to be colorblind when it comes to race. I bet she even has black friends too. Now, also, if you're not from America, I don't know if this is a thing in other countries, but there are usually, there's shortcuts to knowing if an organization is absolute BS. And unfortunately, kids being in the name is one of those things. Family too, if those are in your organization's name, there's a chance you might not be serious about this. But anyway, let's see, we have a demonstrator for one of these meetings, Karen Prey, who said, "Teach character in school, teach wisdom, don't teach race, that's racism." Wait, so some things are racism, apparently. You think the teaching of this is racist? Can we teach about that? Because you say it's racism. Shouldn't people know about this? This is apparently really serious. And let's see. We have a woman testifying in Greenwich, in my home state of Connecticut, saying critical race theory and anti-racism teaching practices are racist, hateful, abusive, and divisive at their core. There is no place for this in our schools. So teaching anti-racism is racist. Okay, now the definition. So what is critical race theory? Well, one definition provided by the Washington Post is that critical race theory is a decades old academic framework that holds that racism is systemic, embedded in government policies and laws that are evident in any serious examination of American history. Critics say that racism is the work of individual bad actors, and they say teachers are improperly injecting race into the classroom. Teachers say it is impossible not to discuss race in any honest discussion or lesson about American history. So it is an analytical framework. It is a way, it is a lens through which to look at history. At saying that racism has been core to our country, which you would think hundreds of years of slavery as the backbone of our economy would sort of make clear, and Jim Crow and all of that. But that's not clear to a lot of people. It needs to be said, and critical race theory is one way that some grad programs look at race. Wozni, not every elementary school, almost none of the kids that these parents supposedly have ever been taught anything like this. But they're very worried about the US government being tarnished as having ever done anything racist, about race ever having been racial bias being built into our economy, into real estate, into education or law or the Supreme Court. They're worried about those sorts of things.
I think the strangest thing to me is it feels like they just want to be able to feel good about people like Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson, right? It's like these guys are our white heroes from the past, and I don't want to be robbed of the good feelings and, you know, just the general positivity that I feel towards these historical figures. And, you know, it's funny to me because I'm like, what do you really have to do or in common with even Abraham Lincoln, random white person in Nebraska? Like, you know, your parents, your forefathers probably came from Ellis Island, from Ireland somewhere, or name any other European country. They have no relation to these guys in any meaningful way. So I don't know, I don't get the sort of temptation to want to hold on to these guys as, you know, part of your core identity as an American. And I also don't understand why we can't just say people made mistakes in the past, and we're not going to do the same thing. We're just going to be better at it. Not that those guys are a specific evil or whatever. They made bad choices. We're going to make better ones.
Yeah.
Keep it pushing. I don't know why that's so hard for people to say. It's just, there's just this strange self-identity wrapped in, you know, you have to believe that the white men of the past were pure and amazing to feel good about yourself. It's just strange to me.
I don't get it. All these parents say, how could you tell my kid that their, like, their original sin was that they're white, it'll ruin and we have to protect them. So here's the thing. I accept all the realities about the massacres, the economic degradation, about, you know, Jim Crow and trying to dilute and eliminate political representation for any non-white group, all that. I accept all of that. So what, why am I still able to be proud of myself and my achievements? Why do I still hold my head? Shouldn't I be ruined by this? We're taught by these crying moms and dads at these meetings. Apparently, it doesn't have to ruin you. Some might say understanding history, having a grasp on reality might actually strengthen you in some way, perhaps psychologically, perhaps emotionally. I don't know. It seems like you should be able to look at the world and get what it actually is. But some disagree, and they're willing to go to extreme lengths over it. So let's turn to our next bit on this. The furor over the non-teaching of critical race theory has gotten so bad that it's not enough now for these right-wing parents to go to meetings and complain about it. They now want surveillance, state surveillance of teachers. A Nevada group called the Nevada Family Alliance, see, family's in the name, has proposed putting cameras on teachers to stop them from teaching critical race theory. The Alliance's suggestion for teachers to wear body cameras followed frustration from parents about the quote lack of transparency by teachers promoting a social justice narrative. Every day, the founder of that group says, we are told of another incident where a teacher is violating the privacy of a student or contradicting the lessons taught by parents at home. So creating a record that could be viewed by appropriate parties if necessary might be the best way to urge teachers to stick traditional teaching. And man, I don't know, does like a shiver up your spine at traditional teaching? How dare a teacher contradict what parents have said? Here's the thing about that. Most parents don't know jack about history. That's why we send our kids to schools, to be taught by teachers who've actually learned this stuff. But Wozni, they want to put the cameras on the teachers. So it's just a little, you can just see the little faces. And when, like you mentioned Tulsa, the little faces are like, no. And then that's evidence in a court proceeding.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, these are the freedom people, right? Freedom, liberty, you know, this is the land of the free, America. Don't tread on me, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same crowd that does that yet wants to surveil teachers. Again, I just don't think this is that critical or that hard to understand, even something, because, you know, we get these buzzwords that come and they go. Now the buzzword of the moment is systemic racism. It's, you know, it's pretty easy to teach to even second graders, like, we're all basically the same. And if a group of people are getting outcomes at a disproportionate rate, we know that there's something else going on because we're all basically the same. We're all human beings. We all bleed when you cut. There's no science behind any of the race stuff. It's just categories that we've made up. And so when we see outcomes that are disproportionate for a certain group of people, then we know something's happened systemically and we probably need to do something to address it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean your mommy and daddy don't love you. That doesn't mean you need to cry every single day because your skin is white. And, you know, people 300 years ago who happened to have the same skin color as you, you know, perpetuated some awful atrocities. Like, this isn't hard. This is so simple. Even children can understand it. And, you know, again, it just shows you what could happen when people are propagandized and sort of taught to be idiots via hate radio on the right wing or Fox News. Like, when you're constantly consuming this stuff, it can turn you to even dumber people than even little kids, right? Like, that's just what this shows you to me.
I love the shot at little kids. Look, they're pretty dumb too, bear in mind. You're not wrong though. So a couple points to your point about the hate radio and, you know, Fox and all that, it's 100% true. Like, if you're conservative, you're watching this, I just beg of you to see reason. Not on everything, that's not gonna happen, but on this one thing. If you think that Tucker Carlson gives a damn about what some public school is teaching kids, you're crazy. Dude's rich. His kids are not only are his kids never gonna go to those schools, they're never gonna have a serious extended conversation with a person who's been to one of those schools. He and all of the other rich MFers who are getting you worked into a frenzy about this don't care about it at all. But I'm sure they're thrilled at how successfully it has taken over millions of right wingers. They're pursuing their economic interests while dangling stuff in front of you. They jangle their keys and then you run to go attack the teaching of critical race theory. By the way, in terms of dumb people, really fast, one more graphic here. The Karen England, the founder of that Nevada Family Alliance, says, we expect that the teachers unions will reject this proposal immediately for the body cameras, but we should ask, what do they have to hide? That's actually a good point. The only reason you could not want to have a body camera on you is because you're hiding something. And I think that's a standard that we can apply to other people. Hey, Karen England, put on a body camera all day and stream it to the internet. If you don't want to do that, what do you have to hide? What are you doing that is so terrible that you wouldn't want your entire privacy to be violated so that busybody parents are constantly asking you about everything that you do and you say? It's so stupid. And the thing that bothers me the most is not that it's stupid, but that I'm sure a dumb point like that is just accepted as like such wisdom by these parents that want to control what people learn. Okay, with that, we're gonna take our first break. When we come back, we've got a lot more to get to, including there are at least two different congresswomen who are facing censure resolutions in the House for very different reasons. We're gonna break down these two cases after this. Okay, so much more news to get to. Before we jump into it though, I do wanna let you know that as every day, we are in week two of an awesome 8-week run of Dr. Rashad Ritchie's show, Indisputable, which is available to watch at youtube.com/indisputabletyt. And I know what you're thinking, wait, but when? We've made it as simple as possible, right after the Damage Report. Damage Report goes until the 30-minute mark, we take a little break, and then there you go. Indisputable, Dr. Rashad Ritchie, it's gonna be awesome. He's got Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's. You know, Ben Cohen's obviously was a big Bernie Sanders surrogate. Josh Bernstein is a conservative host who he's gonna debate. I don't know exactly what they're gonna talk about, but you know it's gonna be awesome. And Adrian Lawrence is once again going to be Dr. Rashad Ritchie's co-host. So it's gonna be an awesome show. You're not gonna wanna miss it. And with that, let's jump back into the news. It's been a couple of weeks since Representative Marjorie Greene compared the wearing of masks to the Holocaust. That was rough at the time, and she actually got pushback on it, shockingly. She sort of apologized at the time. Now she's coming back with what she believes will be a better apology. Here's a bit of that.
Always want to remind everyone, I'm very much a normal person. And I think it's important for me to always be transparent and honest. And I just want to tell you all, I'm really, really lucky. I was blessed with, I am blessed with amazing parents. And my dad just passed away in April. But I will say he taught me some great things. And one of the best lessons that my father always taught me was when you make a mistake, you should own it. And I have made made a mistake, and it's really bothered me for a couple of weeks now. And so I definitely want to own it. This afternoon, I visited the Holocaust Museum. The Holocaust is, there's nothing comparable to it. It happened, and, you know, over 6 million Jewish people were murdered. More than that, there were not just Jewish people, black people, Christians, all kinds of children, people that the Nazis didn't believe were good enough or perfect enough. And the horrors of the Holocaust are something that some people don't even believe happened, and some people deny, but there is no comparison to the Holocaust.
Okay, so she is apologizing. She has been to the Holocaust Museum, so now she gets that it's really serious and everything. Waz, what do you think about her apology?
I guess, you know, at least she's apologizing for something that she did that was clearly just out of line and more than anything, just idiotic, you know. And it speaks to very directly to our current moment. I think, especially those on the other side, they hear things coming from quote unquote our side, John, that they think is our extreme, right? Like abolish the police. Right, like they're like, that's an extreme rhetorical frame. Now, when we go for our turn, we gotta go extreme, right? And so, wearing a mask at Walmart is now the same as being taken to a gas chamber. It's the same, John. It's the same thing. The mass killing of a persecuted group of people, 6 million. Is the same as wearing a mask when you get beef jerky from 7-Eleven. It's the exact same thing.
There's no difference.
It's just ridiculous. There's nothing interesting to say, John. Like, I want to sound smart and interesting on your show because I want to entertain your audience. But how are you smart and interesting about a freaking lady comparing masks in public, you know, sort of stores, et cetera, to mass genocide and killing? Like, how do you sound smart about that? This is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. And yet we have an obligation to try, so I will. yeah, you're right. Okay, so first of all, base level, she is apologizing once again. That is worth something. We're gonna evaluate how much it's worth based on other things that she said in that same press conference, but it's worth something. Not necessarily much for her, but I didn't think that she would be pushed into ever apologizing for anything that she said. So this is a bit of a win, if a minor one, for a world, a reality where there are sometimes, even sometimes, consequences for the insane things that you say. So that's good. I'm glad for that. That said, there's a few issues. So first off, if you have to start your statement with, I'm a normal person, are you though? Normal people don't talk like that, and you just did. Second of all, okay, so I get why in vague terms, she thought going to the Holocaust Museum and then talking about it would be a good idea. Because when you say something that shows ignorance about a group, sometimes they'll like, you'll sit down with people from the group or an expert or something like that. The thing is, not for the Holocaust. Everybody knows that that's really bad. Going to the Holocaust Museum is a great idea to learn more. Not to learn that it's bad, though. It's like I'm walking in the door, wonder what this is about. No, you're supposed to already get the core idea, and then extra layers of detail will be then wrapped about that. And I would also say, I question how much she really learned there. Because while she did say a couple of good things, like for instance, she mentioned 6 million people have been killed. She mentioned that it wasn't just Jewish individuals, but that also a number of other different groups were targeted as well. When you then say they did it because they thought those people weren't good enough, are you a child? Are you a child that's what you took? Well, they really didn't like those people weren't perfect. So that's the most simple. Anyway, she's trying to some extent. The thing about it though was, is that she said, I will own up to my mistakes, which is good. I think that people should do that. They should be rewarded in some fashion, you know, when they do that. It's then immediately undercut by other stuff. So for instance, at that press conference, she was asked by Ryan Nobles if the experience would lead her to reject the disinformation spread by QAnon followers, some of which deny the Holocaust. She said in that thing that some people deny the Holocaust. She said she didn't know of what information was spread by Q followers. That's not true. That's not true at all. You were one of those Q followers. You uploaded popular videos that people who are obsessed with QAnon would watch. You know at least something about what they say, so you're lying there. She also refused to take back her comparisons between the Democratic Party and the Nazis. So an action of the Democratic Party and an action of the Nazis, she gets that she's not supposed to compare those things. But just calling them Nazis, she doesn't take that back. So the Holocaust is like nothing else. There can be no comparisons. But the people who did the Holocaust, oh no, compare away. No, totally, the Democrats are the Nazis at that point. She also refused to denounce Trump for saying that some of the people marching at Charlottesville were very fine people who are literal Nazis. So Waz, how much has she actually learned if she's not willing to take back those things?
Look, I hate to be a cynic here, but I don't think this apology was genuine. I don't know if I'm, you know, going off on a limb there by suggesting that Marjorie Taylor Greene probably already knew that it was unconscionable to compare mask wearing to the Holocaust. Yeah, so I'm not surprised that her apology was bumbling and didn't seem genuine. That doesn't surprise me. And also it wouldn't surprise me that she wouldn't come out and directly denounce Donald Trump, because part of your brand as somebody who's already, you've already self-identified as a Q supporter, like that's just the Donald Trump cult. So why would a cult member come out and denounce the cult leader in public? That just would never happen. And you know, I get reporters' jobs is to hold these people's feet to the fire, so to speak, and ask them the quote unquote tough questions. But I don't know, part of me wonders if taking any of these people seriously at all is part of the problem. Maybe nobody showing up to her rinky dink press conference would have been the right thing to do. Although I know it's important that we document what our public figures are doing, or civil servants are doing. But you know, and you know, the thing about the mask stuff, which is funny to me, because honestly, John, I don't like wearing masks. But like, if I'm at Ross's getting new underwear and the policy is to wear a mask, it's like, it's not a big deal to walk around that store for 15 minutes with a mask on, right? Yeah. Like, I just don't get it. Like, when you don't have to, you just don't do it, right? Mm-hmm. And when you do, you suffer. You suffer for the brief moments that you walk through a restaurant, or you walk through some Target, or you do what, it's just the strangest things, right? I remember when they used to call us snowflakes, you know, because we had the nerve to be offended by stuff like racism and sexism and homophobia. Now these fools can't wear masks for 30 seconds without crying about it. It's incredible to watch.
Oh, and we're gonna have so they cry about it. They also sometimes attack people. So we'll have that a little bit later on too. Really fast, you mentioned homophobia there. Someone pointed out in the YouTube chat, and I hope I didn't just miss it. She was listing the groups that the Nazis were, you know, hunting down and murdering by the millions. Did she mention the LGBTQ community? Because they were totally targeting the LGBTQ. It's weird. So weird. I guess she must have missed that section of the Holocaust Museum. Weird that she wouldn't want to mention that. But good point to the YouTuber with that. Okay, let's turn to the next aspect of this. Both Ilhan Omar and Marjorie Taylor Greene are potentially this week going to be the targets of censure resolutions. So they're going to be filed supposedly this week, admonishing them for marks that critics say were anti-Semitic or inappropriate. But two different women, two different remarks. So we've been talking about Marjorie Greene and her saying that being forced to wear a mask is like being sent to Auschwitz, which seems crazy. I shouldn't have to say why. But what about Ilhan Omar? Well, interestingly, in this case, the same representative is putting the censure resolutions and getting involved in the process of both. You have Representative Brad Schneider, a Democrat, tomorrow supposedly is going to have his resolution condemning and censuring Marjorie Greene. But separately last week, we talked about this letter. He was part of a group of House Democrats who were criticizing Ilhan Omar, accusing her of giving cover to terrorists and suggesting her remarks reflect a deep-seated prejudice. So her remarks were that effectively many groups have committed war crimes and atrocities. The Taliban, Hamas, but also the United States and Israel, which is an objective fact. I apologize if facts are inconvenient sometimes, that's the nature of them. But she is being attacked for that. Now, Greene has been criticized, and not just by Democrats and the damage report and stuff like that. She was condemned by Mitch McConnell, by House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He said she's wrong. Her intentional decision to compare the horrors of the Holocaust with wearing masks is appalling. So that's good, you know, that they actually finally found something that she said that was bad. But they're also trying to draw some sort of parity with Ilhan Omar. And Kevin McCarthy said today that he would bar progressive Ilhan Omar or anybody that has an anti-Semitic, anti-American view. She criticized Hamas and the Taliban in literally the same statement, from serving on the House Committee of Foreign Affairs if Republicans take back the majority in 2022. And she would just be the beginning, I think, Wozni. I think that since Marjorie Greene was stripped from her committees for a billion bat-ass crazy statements, if they get back into control, I mean, God only knows how little you'll have to say for you to be taken off out of your committees.
Yeah, I mean, this is the right wing. This is the reactionary sector of our government, and this is what they do. It's funny to compare what Ilhan Omar said to Marjorie Taylor Greene is hilarious on its face, and it's always this need to quote unquote balance out our sort of discourse, right? Well, there's the Republican version of ridiculousness, of actual insanity, and we have to reach. We have to figure out a way to say, no, but there's a Democratic form of it too. And it's Ilhan Omar, you know, talking about the bombing of Cambodia and Laos, or, you know, the terrible atrocities from Central America with the Sandinistas, or the countless coups that the CIA has backed of democratically elected governments, or the 500,000 brown people who died in Iraq, or, you know, we can just keep going and going and going. Like, you know, to point that out is somehow anti-American, or that means you're not a patriot, to point out that the United States too has carried out numerous atrocities over many years all over the globe, from Africa to wherever, you know. It's just so freaking stupid. It's just about objectivity, both siderism run amok.
100% to claim this, like, she's stating a fact. They've all committed war crimes, all of them. That's just reality. Whereas Marjorie Greene said the Holocaust is like being forced to wear a mask, which is wrong. It's not like that. You know what the Holocaust is like? Two things. First of all, nothing. Second of all, well, if millions of people are killed in another campaign targeting different groups, then that will be like the Holocaust. But other than that, nothing. So she was wrong, and Ilhan Omar was saying a fact that people don't like. And there is nothing the right likes more than attacking people for making them think thoughts that hurt their brain. So anyway, we're gonna have to see what happens with it. You know, Nancy Pelosi says that the House leadership hasn't rebuked Ilhan Omar over her comments, and her putting that out today might be an indication that they're not going to be supportive of some sort of censuring or an attempt to take her out of her committee meetings. We'll have to see about that. I am curious what you all think, though. So we do have a poll. You can go to tyt.com/polls. The question is, will the Democrats come to the defense of Representative Ilhan Omar against GOP attacks? The specific link is tyt.com/poll/Omar-under-attack. I have my worries. I think that the Democrats love to show how reasonable they are by throwing their own under the bus when it's not warranted. They've done it in the past. They've done it in the past with Ilhan Omar. So we'll have to see. I am very worried about it. I'm also worried about what's going to happen with Representative Omar if and when the Republicans retake the majority. So we'll have to see about that. Now, we're going to take the second break of the show. When we come back, things have gotten bad in this country. We're going to give you just a brief bit of what former President Barack Obama thinks and would have predicted would happen. So we'll have that for you, a fun little interview. And then whistleblower reality winner has been released from prison. So we've got those coming for you after this. Okay, let's jump back into this thing. Looking around the country, politics has gotten pretty rough. People are pretty unreasonable, pretty insane, spread a lot of conspiracy theories. Look, things were not great under Barack Obama. They seem a bit more deranged, at least on social media. So what does he think about this? Did he expect that things would ever get this bad? Well, he sat down with Anderson Cooper and here's what he had to say.
Think it would get this dark?
No, I thought that there were enough guardrails institutionally. That even after Trump was elected, that you would have the so-called Republican establishment who would say, okay, you know, it's a problem if the White House doesn't seem to be concerned about Russian meddling, or it's a problem if we have a president who's saying that, you know, neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, there are good people on both sides. You know, that's a little bit beyond the pale. And the degree to which we did not see that Republican establishment say, hold on, time out, that's not acceptable, that's not who we are, but rather be cowed into accepting it, and then finally culminating in January 6th, where what originally was, oh, don't worry, this isn't going anywhere, we're just letting Trump and others vent. And then suddenly you now have large portions of an elected Congress going along with the falsehood that there were problems with the election.
And the leadership of the GOP briefly for a, you know, one night when they still had the sort of scent of fear in them, you know, going against the president.
And then poof, suddenly everybody was back in line. Now,
okay, so look, they covered a lot of ground there, Wozni. It seemed to me like, I understand that his thing is being like very level headed. He doesn't seem that freaked out about anything that's going on. Like, is it just the interview? What did you think about like the general tone there from former President Barack Obama?
I think it's horse crap. I think this idea that the Republicans would be alarmed by anything other than losing is horse crap. All they care about is winning. Before Barack Obama was elected, these fools perpetuated the Iraq war. It was a lie. They lied to the public. We spent trillions of dollars, as I previously mentioned, in a conservative estimate of 500,000 Iraqis died behind Republicanism. You know, this idea that they would just be, oh no, not Donald Trump disrespecting the form of government. Not the formalities, and you know, he's not being nice, but we still get to win and pass our tax cuts and deregulate every single industry from kingdom come to Timbuktu. No, not that. It's insane to suggest that these people would do anything else besides win. They just want to win. They don't care about these niceties that Barack like likes to pretend that these people give a damn about. It's a level of naivety that gets on my nerves, because Larry's a lot smarter than this. It's just ridiculous.
You know, I want to ask you about one thing. So you mentioned that the only thing that would like cause them to freak out would be to lose. So question on that. So, you know, 3 years ago now, they lost the House and they just lost the Senate and the White House. Are they really that freaked out about losing, really? They're not changing, really. I mean, they're changing election laws to make it more difficult like for Democrats to win, but they're not angry at Trump for presiding over all of these losses or Mitch McConnell. They don't seem to mind the people who are in charge. So how freaked out are they?
Well, look, you gotta think about it. There were no actual consequences to having Trump as president for Republicans. Like, not tangible ones, right? Like the apparatus of the government is so huge and entrenched, even having somebody completely disinterested in his own job was pretty much just chugging along until the pandemic happened. You know, like an actual honest to goodness emergency, and it was just like, oh my God, this is a disaster. But besides that, like nothing happened, John. Like we just kind of chugged along while this lunatic, you know, ascended to the highest office in all of the world and basically treated it like a summer camp job, right? Like, you know, he did nothing all day, every single day. So if you're Mitch McConnell's, like, whatever, we'll eventually come back into power in the Senate because the Dems are at a disadvantage because, again, places like Montana send two senators, just like our state, our home state, California. They understand their advantages and they know they can just sit tight, be patient, and do the only thing they care about doing, packing the courts with conservative judges, you know, cutting taxes on corporations and uber rich people and deregulating the hell out of everything. Everything else is like, who cares?
Yeah,
who cares?
I wouldn't be that angry about not being in charge necessarily. I mean, they got the tax cuts. They got a bunch of deregulation. They took over the courts. So the only thing in that case, and so there are two reasons why they might still be freaked out, which is one, if there were a ton of crises facing their base that they just wanted to fix and now they can't because they're not in charge, but they don't care about any of that. I listed all their goals. Waz listed all their goals. The courts, deregulation, taxes, that's about it. The other would be if they were really worried that the Democrats were gonna reverse all that. Well, then you'd wanna be in power because you don't wanna lose all that stuff that you did. They don't seem like they're super worried about that. I mean, they talk about Biden as if he's some sort of like Maoist or something like that, but they don't seem worried enough to, for instance, try a different electoral strategy. So, yeah,
the thing is, John, about like something like tax cuts, it's like those trillions and billions of dollars, they're already in those companies' bank accounts. It's not coming back out, right? Yeah, like they shoveled all that wealth back up to the top and it's not going anywhere. That's entrenched, you know? So like, what does Mitch McConnell care? It's like, my buddies got paid, I'm good.
That is a very good point, fairly indisputable. Actually, no, now that we're talking about indisputable, before we go on to our last story, probably the first hour, indisputable is going to be coming up in about 40 minutes, youtube.com/indisputable TYT. Dr. Rashad Ritchie is gonna be on with Ben Cohen, who we've been lucky enough to have on the show a number of times. Adrian Lawrence as well. He's gonna have a debate with a conservative host, Josh Bernstein. So you're not gonna wanna miss that. 2:30 PM Eastern time, 11:30 AM Pacific time. It's gonna be awesome. And I wanted to remind you, we are in the middle of our generally once a year membership drive, the Be the Change campaign. You know, TYT over the years, even long before I joined, has fought for a lot. And the reason they've been as successful as they've been, with Jenks starting things like Wolfpack and helping to found the Justice Democrats and, you know, try to change the conversation about candidates like Bernie early on and covering things like, you know, covering like Ferguson, covering what happened with Trayvon Martin earlier than the mainstream media, is because you members have always been there to help keep us stable. So if you appreciate what we do, if you value it and know that we're gonna need it going forward, you can go to tyt.com/change to become a member. If you're already a member, thank you. That's it. I just wanted to say thank you. And with that, why don't we jump into this next story? Yesterday, there was a bit of shocking news. I don't know if anyone was expecting this, but the whistleblower, reality winner, was released from prison. Not necessarily totally home free or anything like that, but at the very least on that path, released from prison. Let's see, we have this tweet that was sent out at the time by her attorney, Allison Grinter Allen, who said, "I'm thrilled to announce that reality winner has been released from prison. She is still in custody in the residential reentry process. We are relieved and hopeful. Reality and her family have asked for privacy during the transition process as they work to heal the trauma of incarceration and build back the years lost. Her release is not a product of the pardon or compassionate release process, but rather the time earned from exemplary behavior while incarcerated. Reality is still barred from public statements or appearances, and any inquiries can be handled through my office." So if you're not familiar with Reality Winner, why she was locked up, I'm not that surprised, because for some reason, out of all the whistleblowers and all that, she was talked about very little in her case. Anyway, here is the basic details. She's a former Air Force linguist. She entered a guilty plea back in 2018 after being prosecuted for leaking classified information. She had been arrested the year before and charged with sending a classified report about election interference to reporters at The Intercept. The report described hacks by Russian intelligence operatives against local election officials and a company that sold software related to voter registration. So she had been locked up, given a 5-year sentence for that. And we're gonna talk a little bit about the conditions that she was held under. But Wazi, what's your reaction to her, at least like basically like being put in like a halfway house or something like that?
You know, my reaction is that one of the last things that remains bipartisan about our government is the ghoulish way in which we treat whistleblowers. Barry was freaking horrible on it, and Barry's supposed to be some enlightened cat. He was terrible to whistleblowers, and I'm not surprised that even under a Republican administration, we would be carrying out the same practices and tactics against people who would dare speak out against injustices carried out by not just, you know, other governments, our government too. So yeah, I'm not surprised by this. Like, when it comes to, you know, hawkish military state run stuff, both sides of the aisle are in lockstep. We need to stamp out any and all dissent. Mm-hmm. The military is God in this country, and everything else can just go to hell.
Yeah. And you know, the argument's always been given, like, regardless of the content of the leak, is this is gonna harm our national security.
Oh,
but like, are you ever gonna like describe how, like, are there cases where it actually like, shouldn't it have to before you lock up everyone who does it because it's supposed to?
Officer, so how did this that, yeah, that yeah. Somebody,
and by the way,
was put in danger.
Exactly. And not just for her. You're totally right. This both sidesism in American politics is often BS. It's lazy thinking. But you're totally right. In this case, when it comes to whistleblowers, they all hate him. And by the way, The first whistleblower scandal for Joe Biden is just, it's pending. It's gonna come at some point. They're gonna lock somebody up. I don't know who they are. I don't know what their name is. I already wanna thank them for their courage that they're gonna have to have, because both parties are really bad when it comes to whistleblowers. Yeah, like, people need to have certain information. Like, that's why, whether it's Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, Reality Winner, Julian Assange, leave them alone for the whistleblowing. It doesn't mean that I like every one of these individuals, or they're good people, or they have our interests at heart, or whatever, all the time. But this is they're not demonized for those reasons. They're demonized because they dared to go against the security state, the intelligence apparatus, all of that. And by the way, we want to mention some of the conditions that she had been suffering under. So she had COVID while in prison, which isn't that shocking. So many prisoners did, because our country didn't give a damn. We didn't do anything really to protect prisoners from getting and dying from COVID. Anytime you advocate for literally any better improvement of the conditions in our prisons, you're gonna be attacked for it, because those are not humans. You're not supposed to care about them. Let's see, her prison lost power and heat during last winter's ice storms. A number of her fellow inmates actually died of COVID during that time. And she's just now been moved out of one of those. But go watch John Oliver's most recent episode about overheating in prisons killing people. She very likely would have been subject to that had she been kept in, and now all of the other prisoners still will. So the conditions that these whistleblowers are held in are absolutely devastating. They shouldn't be suffering any consequences, certainly not the consequences that they are. So good that, thanks to her good behavior, she at least got out to some extent. I don't know if she'll ever talk about the experience or anything, but I'm glad that she at least is not in prison anymore. Any further thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we gotta talk about just the awful conditions that people live under in the American prison system more often, honestly. Even practices like solitary confinement, where they keep people in for years in what they call 23-in-1, you know, you're locked in your room for 23 hours a day. You get 1 hour for recreation. You have no human contact. People can't visit you. This is inhumane. It's torture. It's It's shameful what we're doing to American citizens in our prison system. And obviously it's horrible when they do it to whistleblowers, but it's horrible when they do it to anybody who's been considered to have broken a law. They're still human beings and still deserve to be treated with some level of dignity.
100%. And you don't have to leak state secrets to be devastated by our system. In that John Oliver episode, they talked about one guy who was in prison for writing a bad check who died from the heat in the prison. That's what our system is. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this story. But thank you if you've been watching on the linear platform. But if you're on Twitch or YouTube, there's a lot more coming. So we are going to take a short break. When we come back, we've got, let's see, a Supreme Court ruling. It's pretty big one. And more besides, we've got that coming up for you after this. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the last third of the Damage Report. Very glad to have the slightly extended runtime for you so we can cover more stories. And we're about to do that. Before we jump into it though, let me read just a few members' comments, including this is a literal member's comment from Squirrel Nut Mafia, who says, judge not a person by the color of their skin, but rather judge them by what snacks they bring to game night. Yes, that's true. Waz, what snack are you bringing to game night?
Probably something from Trader Joe's. It'll probably be whatever the spiciest potato chip they have. Probably bring a big old bag of that because I love Trader Joe's snacks. And I know I'm not alone in that.
I do like Trader Joe's. Their like candy and stuff is really good. My wife got me really into hot Fritos. Except I swear, I feel like I got COVID and it ruined my taste buds because there was a period of a few months where I loved them and now they're too spicy for me. And I don't understand why that would happen.
That's really interesting. It usually goes in the reverse order of you start something and it's decently spicy and you're like, nah, not spicy enough anymore.
Burns you out, yeah. Okay, so a few super chats for you as well. Lawrence Wells says, hi, John and Waz. That Omar is being censured the same as Green is absolutely as ridiculous as Green herself. It's because of honest people like you who break the monopoly on the narrative. Lawrence, thank you for watching. Appreciate that message. Stephanie Rampley says, Marjorie Taylor Greene also said she previously visited the Auschwitz concentration camp when she was a teenager. So why did she need to go to the Holocaust Museum to get enlightened? These are very good questions, very reasonable questions. Over on Twitch, Cena McMillan gifted 5 tier 1 subs. Thank you very much for that. Thank you, Ty Strong, for subscribing for the 4th month. Vengeful just hit 12 months as a subscriber. That was quite a year. Thank you, Vengeful. Zerklees hit 4 months. Let's see, read that. Brandy Lou gifted 5 tier 1 subs. Brandy Lou so often does. Thank you, Brandy Lou. I see you. I see you gifting subs. The Artsy Fartsy Dragon gifted 5 as well. Couldn't miss your name, Artsy Fartsy. And let's see, over at hashtag TDR Live for a more perfect America says, if anti-racism divides a country, that country needs to reevaluate itself. That's a pretty good point. And with that, let's move on to some more news. The Supreme Court is really on one, regrettably in this case with a 9-0 decision, where there could have been a bit more justice, but then the Supreme Court got involved. So effectively yesterday, they ruled that potentially hundreds of low-level crack cocaine offenders cannot benefit under a 2018 federal law. The First Step Act provision in question made retroactive another law from back in 2010 called the Fair Sentencing Act that was supposed to reduce a disparity that had left sentencing for crack cocaine crimes more severe than for powder cocaine crimes. Now, that wording sort of underplays what's really going on. It's more severe. It's way more severe. The ratio was 100-1. So that a 5-year mandatory minimum penalty, for instance, was triggered by possession of 5 grams of crack, you would require 500 grams of powder cocaine. And black defendants were far more likely to face crack cocaine charges than white defendants, who are more apt to face powder cocaine charges. So it's such a weird coincidence that one was 100 times more penalized. In any event, in this case, Tararik Terry, he's the individual at the center of this, scheduled to be released from prison in September, is black. He is not going to be able to be retroactively have his sentence reduced as a result of this. The reason is just basically a technicality. It's a wording thing in the bill. The authors of the bill are very clear that they intend this to have people like Tarek Terry be encapsulated under it. But in a 9-0 decision written by Justice Clarence Thomas, the court said that the First Step Act was limited by a technical omission. It left out the lowest rung of offenders. So we'll have a little bit more on this. But was they specifically passed a bill in a US government that never passes anything, basically. Trump signed it. This is actually bipartisan to try to take away some of this disparity. Not totally, they were just reducing the disparity. And now it's not going to apply to those people. And the Supreme Court is unanimous in that.
Yeah, you know, the idea that we would stop beating the crap out of black people systemically, it seems to be a really tough pill for the system to swallow, like, you know, collectively, right? These laws were pretty freaking racist at the time. I think in real time, people understood that they were specifically targeting black people, specifically crack, because that drug was synonymous with black people and urban decay, et cetera, right? So at the time, it was obvious that we were coming up with mandatory minimums and this quote unquote war that we were fighting on substances. It was obvious that it was targeted towards black people and the communities that they live in. And, you know, we've seen the consequences that those laws have wrought. And even just the smallest attempt to scale it back is met with resistance, and it's annoying, hilarious, sad, terrible, all of those things at the same time when you consider the current conversation that we're having about the opioid epidemic and who that's specifically affecting and how we look at that as, you know, these people are victims, they need help. You know, addiction is a disease. We need to take care of them. We see the fervor with which we attack that problem. And, you know, we still can't get over the dumb stuff that we did around the crack era.
Yeah. Yeah, you're totally right. Even, and you're right that it's like the system sort of like lashing back out. Like some of the system seemed to have finally evolved. Yeah. They wanted to change this. And here's the thing that bothers me about this story is that you might watch this, especially maybe if you're not from America, and think, oh, well, then what's the problem? They just fix the language. Not so fast with that. So just because they passed it and Trump signed it and it seemed bipartisan, in theory, you should be able to knock this thing out in 20 minutes. Have a little bill that just modifies the wording a little bit, make it consistent with what the Supreme Court expects it to say for it to count for this lowest level of offenders. That's not the way the US government works at all. It's gonna be another 20-year campaign of activists. And God forbid if we don't get a Kardashian to bring this to the White House for it to actually work. This should be the easiest fix ever. And that's very rarely the takeaway from one of these stories. But I have no faith that they're gonna quickly fix this. Tarek Terry could end up spending years more in prison as the system sort of slowly gets back up to speed. Anyway, let's move on to other aspects of the inertia in the system that are frustrating. There we go. Nice. Thanks. We've been trying to put pressure on Kyrsten Sinema to get her to change her position on getting rid of the filibuster so that bills like the For the People Act can actually be passed. She either doesn't watch or isn't interested in what we have to say. But thankfully, we're not the only ones. Others are trying to pressure her, including in her home state of Arizona. So just today, I came across an op-ed by the Secretary of State for Arizona, Katie Hobbs, who had a bit to say about the war on democracy that the Republicans are currently prosecuting and how she can potentially get involved. Thank you, Sophie, our producer, is pointing out that she's going to be running for governor. Thank you, Sophie. So here is what Katie Hobbs had to say. Democracy is under siege in Arizona. As part of the big lie that Republicans have been pushing about electoral fraud, they're conducting an audit in our largest county. Most Arizonans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents understand that the audit is a farce. But Republicans aren't just protesting the results of our most recent presidential election. They are laying the groundwork to steal the next one. This twisted logic has propelled voter suppression laws across the country in Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Montana, and other states. So look, if you've been watching this channel, you know this. We've been talking about this ad nauseum. Something needs to be done. And in theory, something like the For the People Act could do quite a bit to actually help out. The thing is, right now, it doesn't seem like that's gonna pass for two reasons. First of all, the Republicans would just veto it, or veto, they would filibuster it, effectively vetoing it. And even if they weren't to do that, as of right now, Senator Joe Manchin hasn't even signed on to it. But first things first, with the filibuster. So Katie Hobbs says the For the People Act is in jeopardy because 50 Republican senators and several Democratic ones are not taking the steps needed to pass it. Democrats, including Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, either do not support the bill or refuse to touch the filibuster, an arcane Senate rule that has often been used to block voting rights in order to bring the bill to a vote. Sinema and I serve the same state. We both know that if we do nothing now, Arizonans' access to the ballot will be stripped away by the Republican legislators. If Republicans want to make the right to vote a partisan issue, that's their problem. I know, and I believe the US senators know too, that access to the ballot isn't a red or blue policy, but a basic American value. I mostly disagree with that last point. It clearly has become a very partisan issue, but I agree with her that something needs to be done. And she closes saying, I am taking what steps I can to fight back on a local level, but I cannot succeed without help from Congress. Please act decisively and pass the For the People Act. We are running out of time. So, you know, Waz, she's not like burning Sinema to the ground or anything, but no, she is calling her out. What are your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I wish she would burn it to the ground. Not literally, obviously, you know, be peace, love, and happiness over here. But you know what I mean? Rhetorically, I would love to see her come after this woman because, again, we talked about when the Republicans know what they want, they go after it and they get it. This idea that Mitch McConnell or anybody within the Republican Party would come out for, say, a big tax cut that couldn't get through because Democrats wouldn't help them pass a bipartisan bill. You think they would come out and say, wait, hold on, guys, we really want to do it, but the Dems aren't on board yet. We got to get the Dems on board because bipartisanship is everything. Like, you know, we need Nancy and the whole Democratic Party to be on board with our bills, because bipartisanship is more important than everything else. No, you've never heard them say that or do that. When they want something, they get it done with or without the Democrats. Like this idea that this woman is giving countless press conferences at this point to talk about the sanctity of the filibuster and working together, reaching across the aisle. Show me the proof. Just show me the proof that bipartisanship is what Americans love and want more than anything. It's insanity.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, and another form of the insanity, I think, is like politicians above all are supposed to be ambitious and pragmatic. Like they're supposed to care about their power. Like we all understand that. But in multiple ways, they're not doing that. Like Joe Manchin is pursuing a political strategy that will almost certainly result in him being in the minority in the Senate in a couple of years. Now, we've previously talked about why I think he doesn't especially care about that. And I think that that remains. But like he still, in theory, wants to be in the Senate. And you would think Kyrsten Sinema would as well. So Kyrsten Sinema is maintaining a filibuster that is going to result in the For the People Act not being passed. And that is going to substantively lower the chance that she gets reelected to that seat. Like they're changing laws in Arizona to make it hard for Democrats to vote, to make it easier to overturn elections. How does she not get that if she does win and it's not a blowout, like if it's a squeaker, then they're not just gonna audit her election and some future Republican governor of Arizona isn't going to overturn it and decide, you know, I'm just gonna appoint who I want. Like I hope that it never comes to that. But it certainly seems plausible and much more plausible as Arizona Republicans continue to decimate voting rights there. Like I don't get why they aren't scared about what is going to happen to their own careers if they don't do something about the laws that we're seeing being passed around the country.
She must have it on good authority that if she plays ball, she's safe. I don't know. This woman's political instincts seem to be pretty crap. That you wouldn't want to put your name on stuff that's highly popular around the country just makes no sense. And I think part of it is just like, if they do get rid of the filibuster, that would mean that they would have to work
Yeah,
they would have to do their jobs. You know, they would have to actually govern. There would be no excuses. When you're Joe Manchin, you like being in a minority. You're not expected to do anything. We don't have any power. We can't pass anything. You just get to show up to work, pass the time, eat your free lunch, and do what you do. Right? That seems pretty obvious to me that this dude has absolutely no interest in governing this country.
I bet that free lunch is pretty good.
I would assume so too.
Well, it looks like our poll results are in. So we asked you, will the Democrats actually stand up for Ilhan Omar? Will they defend her? So let's bring those up and see what y'all thought. So, sometimes they're close, usually not. So, will the Democrats come to the defense of Representative Ilhan Omar against GOP attacks? Looks like about a little bit less than 13% of you thought that they would. Get near towards over 87% think that they won't. And look, so thank you to everybody who went and voted at tyt.com/polls. There's other polls up there if you want to have your voice heard. They read them on the main show and all that. That said, someone pointed out the wording maybe is a little bit off, but in a subtle way. The attacks aren't just coming from the Republicans, like Democrats signed on to that letter too. But that said, we still want to know if they're going to defend her. And so thank you to everybody who got involved with that poll. Now that said, I think that we have time for one more topic. So this is kind of a doozy, but let's jump into it. Earlier this year, as we started to emerge from the pandemic, there were a number of very high profile instances of mass violence with guns. These mass shootings became common once again after about a year of not really having them. Now, I don't think that they're really making news in the same way as they were earlier in this year, but that does not mean that they've stopped. And there have been a lot of horrible mass shootings, just for instance, over the past weekend. So let's run through a bit of the gun violence that we're seeing. At least four major US cities were reeling from an onslaught of mass shootings that left 38 people wounded and 6 dead. And it's spread across the country. In Chicago, a woman was killed and 9 other were wounded when 2 men opened fire on a group standing on a sidewalk in the Chatham neighborhood on the city's south side. In the South Georgia city of Savannah, police said 1 man was killed and 7 other people were wounded in a mass shooting Friday evening. 2 of the wounded were children, an 18-month-old and a 13-year-old. About 4 hours later, over in Austin's downtown entertainment district, I think it might have actually been on 6th Street, a shooting left 1 dead, 13 people wounded, and another in critical condition. And by the way, if you look at overall, the Gun Violence Archive, an online site that tracks shootings across the country, reports that there have been 270 mass shootings so far this year. This is, they define it as any incident in which 4 or more people are shot. So, I mean, it was pretty much all over, and that's just the weekend, Waz. So we had this like brief reprieve from gun violence, but it really seems like it's coming back.
Yeah, and you know, you often do see a spike in violence across the country in the summer months because people are just outside, nothing to do, and it's hot. and so that's just something that generally happens. And yeah, I'm not surprised that while people were inside, they managed not to shoot each other as much last year, right? Which was a nice thing for once. But you know, it's disheartening because I think people in this country have been conditioned to think that violence is just a part of what we do here. It's just, it's as guaranteed as the sun rising in the east every single morning. There's just going to be violence in America, particularly of the gun kind, because people got it in their heads that guns are integral. Yeah, thanks. are integral to our lives here in this country. Like, people just dumb enough to think that. I feel actually thankful to have grown up in New York City where the gun stuff wasn't a thing. In fact, they came out with extremely punitive gun laws. Like, if you were found to be with a gun, you get like 2 years minimum, right? Oh, wow. And I think that went a long way in decreasing gun violence and just an idea that just like, you know what? I'm not gonna bring this thing out or around me if I don't absolutely have to, because if the cops just search me, I'm going to the freaking pokey. And so, you know, I feel thankful to have grown up in an environment where you weren't too worried about who's got a gun or who doesn't. But yeah, this stuff is disheartening, man. People getting shot left and right.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It is left and right. I too, like, I don't actually, at the time, I wasn't that familiar with Connecticut gun laws, but I grew up in Bridgeport. And you know, you were worried about getting jumped or whatever, but you weren't worried about getting shot necessarily. So that was nice. Now there's just way more guns, always more guns. Take a look at this map. This is number of gun deaths over just the first part of this year or whatever. It is all over. Like, and look, I don't necessarily know what like all the solutions are or what would work fastest or, but I do know this. I don't think that more guns is a solution. I'm like willing to bet all of the few dollars that I have that the issue isn't that not enough people are packing guns, I think. Just so many. We're at 40% more than at this point in 2020, which granted, you know, was pandemic times. We're 65% higher than we were in 2019. Like we're making up for lost ground. That is just terrible.
Yeah.
Now really fast.
Yeah, and there's no end in sight either. So no, I'm just saying there's no end in sight to this either. I don't know how we get this thing corralled and under control. There just seems to be violences just seem to be spiking all over the place. I've seen people trying to figure it out via studies, etc. We probably won't understand the reasoning for years to come, but it seems like the country is just becoming more and more violent by the day.
It does. And you know, it's spreading everywhere. You can't even go to Disneyland to get away from it. Through mid-April, police have already arrested at least 14 people at Disney for toting guns. America, what is wrong with us? It's Disneyland. Like I don't necessarily want to be approached by those costumed people any more than you do, but waving a gun at them is not the solution. Are there scary things? Yes, I've been in the Winnie the Pooh ride. That thing is trippy, but you don't need to shoot anything in it. It's a small world. It's not that dangerous of a world, okay? Why are people bringing guns to Disneyland? It's kids everywhere. People are saying lines are too long, kill them all. No, like it's not gonna solve any of your problems. So one person, a South Florida man, weird, checked into the Polynesian Village Resort with an AR-15 and a 9mm handgun in his luggage, explaining that he brought them along to protect his wife and two kids from Black Lives Matter protesters. What? So two things. One, are Black Lives Matter protests going on at Disneyland right now? Is that a thing in Epcot? I don't know. And second of all, you need an AR-15 to protect them from protesters? But of course he thinks he does. He watched that gun-toting weirdo and his wife was wearing like the prison jumpsuit or whatever, waving guns at people who are walking by their car or by their house. You don't need it there. And I get it. We were all horrified at that story a couple of years back where an alligator dragged someone's kid away into a pond in Disney. That was horrifying. It's probably not gonna happen again and you don't need your AR-15 to avoid it.
Yeah.
Disney.
If there was any proof that we've completely gone off the deep end collectively as a society on the gun question, it's people bringing toting gats to go see Minnie and Mickey Mouse. Like that is just, and by the way, the excuse given being Black Lives Matter, I mean, I don't know. I don't think I'm the most tapped into Black Lives Matter in the protest movement, but I'm pretty sure Disneyland and Disney World are low on the list of places that they're gonna be making demands at. I don't know. Yeah, it's like, you know, stop the cops from killing us, Goofy and Minnie Mouse. I don't understand this.
Yeah, I don't remember that part of the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. Anyway. Okay. Well, Waz, thank you. As always, we're always lucky when you take time out to join us on the show. So thank you so much. Until next time, where can people watch more of your work?
Yeah, obviously you guys should be checking out the Waznia Twitch stream on the TYT Twitch network every night. every Tuesday and Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time to 9 p.m. Check us out. We try to do politics. We try to talk about grub. We try to talk about relationships. We try to stick everything in there at once, John. So check out Wozniak when you get a chance. And yeah, just please check out my work at theringer.com. I do podcasts over there. I do a little bit of writing. Check me out at theringer.com. And subscribe to the Woke Bros, me and Nando Vila's political podcast every Thursday morning. That's out for you guys. So subscribe to the Woke Bros wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Sounds like fun. Thank you, man. Have a good one.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. Unfortunately, it looks like that's all the time we have, but that's not all the content CYT has. Do you know that after the break we're about to throw to, Dr. Rashad Ritchie is going to be coming for Indisputable? And you might be thinking, well, where do I watch it? Well, you watch it at youtube.com/indisputableTYT, obviously. You go there, you hit the subscribe button, and then it'll be waiting for you every day after the damage report. Doesn't that sound like fun? You got like 6.5 more weeks of Dr. Rashad Ritchie to look forward to, and you want to be ready for it. So that's coming up very soon. Thank you to everybody for watching the show, for liking and sharing the stream, letting people know that we're live. If you interacted with us, appreciate all your comments. Even if we can't get to all of them during the show, I do read all of them. So please keep those coming in, and thank you so much. Until next time, stay safe out there, stay sane out there, and I'll see you soon. For many Americans across basically every type of job, burnout was one of the things you had waiting for you. If you were lucky enough to continue to have a job during the pandemic, it was pretty much ubiquitous. And there were some career fields that, sort of by the very nature of people staying at home, might have taken off a bit, some forms of media and content creation. But those people too found that the pandemic was tough times, that the trends that we were already seeing before we entered into 2020 were only exacerbated by it. Joining us now to break this down after producing some amazing research on this, we have a technology reporter for the New York Times, Taylor Lorenz. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So I read your piece in the New York Times about young creators on things like TikTok and Instagram. What made you want to look into burnout in these fields?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, throughout the pandemic, as so many people got laid off, a lot more people turned to the content creator industry. You saw a lot of people that formerly had retail jobs, you know, trying to make it as social media influencers. People started streaming and all of that. So there was really this boom in creators. It's the fastest growing segment of small business in America. And I wanted to look at sort of how that was affecting the actual people, you know, that are working, streaming sometimes 16 hours a day with no time off and no labor protections or anything like that. So decided to just call some of them up, and it was sort of uniformly, they all said the same thing, which is that they were experiencing a mental health crisis.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that, especially for Twitch, which seems to incentivize people doing extremely long streams. That does seem difficult. So I'm curious, the people you talk to, I'm sure some of them probably got their start over the last year, but for those who might have been around for longer, was this a thing where 2020 was especially bad, or has this been a problem for a long time?
This has been a problem for a long time. I mean, I think people in this industry have kind of normalized it. They're just like, well, unfortunately, that's how it is, you know? And there was one kid that I spoke to that talked about sort of feeling like he could become irrelevant any day, just by some big tech company changing an algorithm. You know, these tech companies want to sell this version of creators as entrepreneurs, right? They try to say, hey, you're starting your own business, right? But you're building it all on the back of these tech platforms that ultimately hold the cards. And so it can just be a really precarious profession. And it's why a lot of people don't do it for years. You know, so many people only last a couple of years. They don't make a long-term career out of it.
Yeah, and I have to assume that, you know, it's become easier for people to get on a lot of these platforms. That's probably leading to saturation. Is that part of the fear about the possible irrelevancy, that there's always going to be somebody else who's working super hard that might try to, you know, take your audience or whatever?
Yeah, there's always someone behind you. There's millions of people behind you. I mean, you're essentially competing against every single other person on the internet. A lot of people have asked, you know, why don't these creators try to unionize or whatever? And a lot of these groups have tried to sort of collectively negotiate with these tech companies for protections or money or things like that. And it's always been pretty unsuccessful, because these tech companies know that even if this current wave of people is gone, there's, you know, so many waves behind them that will work for less money and you know, sort of not ask for the same types of things.
Exactly. You know, in your piece, you talked about how The technology industry has been one of the chief beneficiaries of, as you just pointed out, that there's always going to be these creators making content for them. They can basically create the platform and then the creators will go there. So how is the tech industry benefiting? Is it financial?
Oh yeah, I mean the tech industry just continues to rake in money from all of these people. You know, they like I was saying, they sort of try to say, oh well, you're getting this independence. You know, you're building your business on here, but they're taking, you know, they're using the content that you create that belongs to them. You know, they are monetizing basically the engagement that these content creators are generating. And these, you know, ultimately these content creators are putting money in Mark Zuckerberg's pocket, right? Or you know, the head of TikTok's pocket, because the people that own the tech companies are the ones that are really cashing in. And they're benefiting. And they're benefiting not just monetarily, but they're getting, you know, their platforms are getting more clout and more influence. And they then, you know, can lobby harder for whatever they want in our government. It's just, it really just adds to their social, political, and economic capital.
You know, I know that over the past few years, it's become pretty typical for businesses to at least try to put across the idea that they care more about the like mental, you know, health of their employees, focusing on things like wellness and stuff like that. Have we seen that at all on some of these platforms? Any sort of concern for the long-term welfare of their creators?
Yeah, I think on an individual platform basis, like, you know, when a ton of top YouTube creators began burning out in 2018, the platform made a bunch of kind of statements. One of their product managers started to speak out. They said they'd make changes to kind of stymie burnout. TikTok has done sort of similar things. I think TikTok's been a little bit more helpful to creators that have actually reached out for help. But the problem is systemic. It's bigger than any one of these tech companies. It's this entire system where, you know, people feel like they have to turn to the internet to sell themselves or sell their personality online because they have no job security elsewhere, and they feel like that's a more stable position to be in. So it's a symptom of this broader sort of society. Also the fact that this class of workers has no protections, right? Like all these people are independent contractors. They're not like employees of Instagram or any of these companies. And you see this with the gig economy, right? Too, like these are independent contractors. They're not really our employees. They don't work for us. So we don't need to give them benefits or time off or mental health care, because ultimately they're just on our platform. They're using our platform.
Is that something that any of the creators that you talked to brought up as a potential solution? Or if not that, have they given you any ideas of things that they think would help them?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have spoken up in this space. Lee Jin, who's a very famous investor, actually pioneered a lot of investment in this space, has actually called for things like a universal creative income, which would basically be like a universal basic income for people working in creative arts. I think that a lot of these creators have wanted more from the company. You know, they would love to take a week off and not feel like they're losing traction in the algorithm, for instance. If there was like a way for them to almost have an out of office, you know, there's no out of office for YouTube or TikTok, really. So I think that there's a lot that could be done from a product standpoint and just from a larger sort of societal standpoint to protect these people.
Yeah, well, as you've alluded to, there's a lot going on here. And we've, you know, barely even touched on some of the specific interviews that you did. So if anyone's watching this, wants to read Taylor's work, it is available at the New York Times, titled Young Creators Are Burning Out and Breaking Down. There's a lot there. Taylor, thank you. I want to thank you both for the work and for joining us on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.